Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. What Raj Tandy surfaces in this conversation is easy to miss if you're only looking at agri-food through production or policy. She draws attention to a quieter layer of the system, the point where food either becomes part of everyday life or remains abstract, even when it's available. And she's very clear in her own way that this is where a great deal is decided. Not in fields or boardrooms, but in kitchens, habits, and competence. A recurring thread in what she shares in today's episode is that the barrier is rarely supply. It's literacy. It's comprehension. People don't cook what they don't understand. They don't buy what they don't recognize. And they don't integrate what doesn't feel like it belongs to them. That gap between what exists and what is actually used, it's not a minor inefficiency. It's structural. And this is why her work operates directly in the spaces we should be paying more attention to. What becomes apparent over the course of this conversation is that translation between cultures, ingredients, and contexts is doing far more than we tend to acknowledge. It's shaping demand, influencing value, and determining whether local food systems are lived or merely discussed. When Raj adapts or presents a recipe, she's not just sharing technique, she's altering the conditions under which certain ingredients become viable. There's also a more complex dynamic at play. She's working across overlapping systems. Diaspora traditions, regional and local agriculture, digital audiences, and instead of flattening those differences, she lets them interact. That creates something more adaptive, but also more difficult to categorize. It resists the tidy narratives that the sector often prefers, and instead allows for a nuance and complexity that enables all sorts of opportunities for entrepreneurs and families alike. By the end of this discussion, the usual hierarchy, production first, culture second, starts to feel inverted. The question is no longer just what we grow, but whether people know how to live with what's grown around them. That shift, subtle as it is, has significant implications for how we think about resilience, markets, and of course, leadership in our food system. Raj, welcome to the Future Herd.
Thanks for having me.
Now, as much I want to discuss with you today, partly because you really fit my larger agenda that leadership in the present and in the future really comes down to communications and understanding your audience and engaging your audience. But the first question that I throw out now to all of our guests, it's rather abstract, it's rather sweeping, it's meant to be very subjective, but what does the future mean to you?
The future as in the abstract or the future of food?
It's for you to decide. This is kind of meant as like a rolling of the dice. You could talk about the future of food. You could talk about the future of yourself. You could talk about a collective future. Or alternatively, you could talk about a future you desire that you want everyone to see so that we can rally towards it.
Okay, so you caught me off guard with this one, but because we live in this world right now where everywhere I go, every dinner party I'm at, every gathering I'm at, everyone's talking about AI. And all my friends, which younger children, I have children also, but they're in university, you know, everyone's really worried about AI. And right now, my biggest concern for the future, my hope, my desire, everything wrapped in one, is that we can continue as a community, as humanity, to like, maintain that our critical thinking skills, our empathy, who we are as humans comes first. And all of these things that we have access to, AI, social media, all these mediums that you and I are using to spread information, these are just tools. And my kind of big picture goal for the future, or what I want to see in the future, is for my children to be empathetic, kind, you know, using all the parts of their brain that they're supposed to use, not off, like, outsourcing those to technology. And I think in many ways that also relates to food. You know, I want people to, when I think about how I, where I sit in the food ecosystem and where I sit in the future of food, I think it's about keeping people connected to the food. You know, it's not always about the hack or the shortcut or the easiest way around. It's about figuratively and literally touching the soil, like knowing the food, knowing the process. It's not about always finding the shortest way from A and B or like a quick way to get there, but maybe engaging with your food, being kind to the community that's building your food. So many people who know me in real life, they tell me, you know, I see the world with rose-tinted glasses, or I always see the best of all things. But I am always wishing for like empathy and kindness in the future in every possible way.
Right on. And in spite of it catching you off guard, I think that may have been the best answer to that question in our modest, I believe it's 12 episodes so far. So you're off to a fantastic start. And I absolutely want to talk about empathy and food and culture and the way it connects us. But I also want to indulge in a question that I'm not able to ask most of the guests that we've had so far. But in your case, even though I suspect it's going to catch you off guard again, that this is a question you're uniquely positioned to answer, which is, what has your relationship with the internet been like? And I say this because with most people, I might ask, you know, how did you get into the industry? Or, you know, how did you become a farmer, right? Or, you know, when did you get into policy around agriculture? And that's a way for the guest to kind of not so much establish their expertise, but give a bit of an origin story. But you have an expertise and a knowledge of the internet that I want to tease out first. So, you know, rather than give you the abstract, what's your relationship to the internet, which you can take if you want, when did you realize that the internet was an opportunity for you, a way for you not just to have fun, but to be, for lack of a better word, professional when it comes to the way you use the internet?
Okay, so I'm one of the people who I think you could consider a dinosaur in the social media space. I have been blogging since 2011, so this is my 15th year blogging. And my relationship with the internet, funny enough, also is really closely related to my relationship with food. So without going really deeply into a backstory, I started a little Flickr page in 2011. I was between jobs. I was figuring out kind of what I wanted to do. My background is in PR, marketing, economic development. So I had, you know, I want to be fair and say I came to this with a skill set in communications, but not everybody at that time, I think, understood what social media could be. And at the same time as I was going through this career shift, I was going through, my family was going through some upheaval. My husband and I both were out of work at the same time. The finances were crunched. Our kids were little. They were like 5 and 8. And I was trying to feed really fussy, picky kids with a limited budget, limited cooking skills, limited patience, and trying to get them to also eat culturally relevant food. So I started posting pictures on my Flickr account of my attempts at recreating food that my mom and grandma had made, you know, my attempts at upgrading myself from a boxed mac and cheese cook to somebody who could actually cook things. And two amazing things happened for me. One is I discovered my passion for food. I came to food really later in my life. You know, people love cooking when they're young. I discovered it in my early 30s. But the second thing that happened is I'd go to Twitter, talk about something, and other people would say, like, say if I was talking about a traditional recipe, they would say, oh, I always wanted to make that, but my mom never wrote it down. I don't know how to say that herb's name in English. I don't know what that spice is called in English. And I think something kind of clicked for me that there was an entire community of second gen Canadians who were living in that same space as me. So I discovered really early on, you know, to answer your question, that the internet had the power to create communities. From the get-go, my community has been built on people who shared similar struggles, similar anxieties, similar kind of food histories and stories. And then, you know, it just kind of took on a life of its own from there. I, you know, went, I took culinary classes. I really dug into like my interest in food. But at the same time, I started realizing that the recipes are important, but more important were the conversations in DMs and the things people were asking me, the level of trust people were giving my opinion. Like, it would blow my mind, you know, strangers would message me to send me a picture of something they cooked and say, I successfully did this. I was able to do it. Or this is my question. And, you know, my relationship with the internet has been amazing. You know, a lot of people say, you know, social media is a difficult place. You know, social media is a mean place. I, knock on wood, would say 95% of the time have great experiences online. But I also think that goes back to the fact that I'm really not trying to sell anybody anything. I'm always trying to build community. So I think, you know, it is, I always say to people, this is really bizarre and I'm kind of off on a tangent, but people always find this funny that there's this old book in business. It's called like, How to Make Friends or Think and Grow Rich or something like that. And in that book, they're always talking about how your network matters and the people you talk to and the people that you know. And I think of, like, I've always thought of social media and the internet in that way, that I wasn't ever trying to reach everybody. I was just trying to speak to the people who needed my message. So in that sense, the internet has been good to me. Most of my career, most of the things I do, you know, whether it's my role with BYBC as chef ambassador, the work I do for CBC, my recipe column in the Vancouver Sun, it all came out of this one decision to start tweeting, which doesn't exist anymore. I'm not even on that app anymore. That platform doesn't exist. Just because I started tweeting what I was cooking for dinner and a community was created out of that.
I have to push back initially and say, because you're clearly not a dinosaur. And I get that there is a kind of ageism on the internet, that once you reach a certain age, young people may not show the respect that in your case you clearly deserve. But you are clearly a community builder. And I want you to kind of elaborate on the power of community on the internet. Because on the one hand, you're speaking from a sense of confidence, a sense of not optimism, but benefit. And transparently, this is where you and I share something in common. Because I've also benefited tremendously from being part of communities on the internet. And I've often told people that the secret to my success, the secret, in fact, to my happiness has often been the communities that I'm part of online. And I think this is something a lot of people don't understand, like if they haven't experienced it, if they haven't been part of it. So I'd love for you to unpack what you see as kind of leadership within these communities. And you kind of alluded to it where earlier you evoked empathy and, you know, you sort of suggested that part of your success is you're not selling anything. And I would go even further. I would say that you're actually actively giving, right? You're giving recipes, you're giving culture, you're giving all sorts of insights that are, you know, part and parcel of your own experience. But I suspect you have experienced bad or dysfunctional online communities compared to ones that are really empowering for all the members. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on why, on what works, on the role of leadership within that kind of community building, either through your own experience or through people that you've observed who maybe you've learned from in terms of watching how they've handled either conflicts or just opportunities when it comes to making people feel like they belong.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, I think that social media is a really great testing ground for future leaders, because that's just the world we live in now, you know. At some point, if you're going to have a leadership role, it's going to have to be transferable to social media, I feel. I don't think it's going to go away. And, you know, leadership on social media, it's a lot of listening. I feel like there's this misconception that being, you know, big on social media is about being a one-way speaker, because if you have, you know, it's an amazing metric to have 100,000 followers, but that doesn't mean that I'm on a megaphone now shouting at 100,000 people. I'm still listening to the people, taking that information, distilling it. It's kind of like having a live feedback loop, right? Like at any given time, I can put out a recipe. I actually put out a recipe yesterday that bombed. I really thought it would do better, but I realized something. I put out a recipe that was based on a vegetable that right now is at prime high, like it is really priced out of a lot of people's budget right now. It's just cauliflower, but cauliflower is so expensive right now that I didn't read the room. And I think the reason that that recipe didn't do well is because it's not the right time to be asking people to buy that vegetable. So, you're in a constant feedback loop. Every single day there's a trend, there's people to react to. So I think that the community building aspect, the leadership is one, I mean, if you're going to approach social media as I'm just doing it because people tell me I have to do it, then don't even do it. Like, I'm sorry. Like, I'm just going to say the thing. If you don't believe in it, if you don't believe that the people whose opinions matter are there and bringing them into your community matters, then it's never going to work for you. While I wear many hats that are maybe more mainstream, but on my Instagram page, my focus really is documenting, preserving heritage Punjabi recipes and also making them accessible to North American cooks, particularly people who have different ingredients. So in that capacity, I have got to have my ears open and I have to listen. And I will read comment streams from people, and I get some people on the internet can be kind of irritating, and you feel really compelled to tell them, your opinion. But I'll read comments like on other community pages, and I'll see really defensive responses from the author, or people being really upset that someone asked for further, not justification. Sometimes people want to understand your recipe, right? They want to know why you suggested this step. And people get really defensive. And I'm not gonna lie, sometimes I feel that way, but I try and step away and come back. And I have really tried to take the perspective always that in this busy, busy world where people could consume a million things, if you will give 90 seconds of your day to my reel to watch it, to ask me a question, I will 100% give you the same respect back. And I feel like to me, as someone who doesn't work in a traditional leadership role, but I have worked in companies before, I have worked in government, I have worked in an agency setting where that's not the kind of treatment I got from leadership. Sometimes when you're new and you ask a question, it's like, really? You had the audacity to ask me that question? Whereas I think on social media, what I love about social media, and if somebody's listening who is, you could be an expert in anything. You could be an expert in lentils, tomatoes, I don't know, the cello, anything. And you could be a thought leader in like a month because you took the time to put your information out. I love the internet and social media. And I think to sum up my very long tangent, yes, I have had some bad experiences. There are bad apples in every industry. I watch the videos where people are like, content creator did this to me, an influencer did that to me. I can't believe someone said this to me. But you just gotta find your people. Like, don't waste your time on the spaces that aren't your people.
And I have to certainly feel affirmed here in the sense that part of my desire to have you on the show, part of my desire to pick your brain is that you're absolutely confirming is that through the journey you've taken, you are understanding a model of leadership that it's something we need to be teaching people, it's something we need to be sharing. And you've used a bunch of words already, like empathy and respect and community and listening, which are all, I think, to you and I, as people who live on the internet, is kind of self-evident, but maybe to a lot of institutional leaders are things that they still need to be wrapping their heads around. But you also described something that I think is not just brilliant, but really important when understanding Canada's agri-food system, and in particular, the way in which we as a country can live up to our potential. Because you hear all this talk about, Canada as a superfood power, Canada as an agricultural power. But I've always regarded Canada as an intersection of diasporas. That if you're honest about looking at where Canada's come from, where Canada is, and where Canada's going, it is a network of different diasporas spanning all over the world. And what you described is not just an approach to a diaspora, where on the one hand, you want to reinforce culture, you want to celebrate culture, you're doing an intergenerational pass down of culture. But you're also making it accessible. You're inviting other people to learn about the culture, to understand the diaspora. To, you know, I saw a video of a rainbow roti that I thought was, again, a really powerful way to make these things accessible. This might be self-evident to you, right? You may just be doing this because you're having fun and you're doing this. But I think there's something really profound in how you're building these bridges between cultures. I'd love for you to unpack that. I'd love for you to describe kind of how you found yourself doing that and the reward or the success, I think, that has come from being able to play that.
You know, I never thought about this until this precise moment because of your question. I think being second generation Canadian, which I think all of us are, but not everyone identifies like that because of all sorts of things that would take way too long to unpack. But, you know, my parents immigrated from India, from Punjab in the early 1970s. So, you know, being second generation, I think you learn very young automatically to balance two worlds, you know, because we had our world at school and our world with our parents. We have our what we call English food, which is the strangest bucket we put food in that's not our, you know, traditional foods. So I guess for that reason, it never felt like a strategic, it never felt strategic for me to be like, how do I take a recipe and make it work with, you know, what I can find in Canada, what is grown here, what's in the grocery store here, because that's how I grew up. You know, I grew up with my mom being like, I used to find this at home, but I can't anymore, so we substitute it here. So I think in that way, saying I'm going to take something and I'm going to make it accessible, and then I'm going to use language that someone who reads a Canadian cookbook or a Canadian recipe can understand, but I'm also going to use traditional language. All of that just, that's just how I am. Like, that's how me and my friends who are the same culture as me, we behave. And, you know, to your point about how that kind of fits into the agri-food system, I feel like that is a skill that I've never thought until this moment with this conversation with you, that if we could reverse engineer it from plate to, you know, policy, versus I feel like so much works from policy to plate, you know, then we would realize that, like you said, the plates in home kitchens in Canada, they do not always look like meat and potatoes. They do not always look like what we have grown and farmed for generations, because there are so many communities and so many diasporas, and we almost do have to learn how to speak this duality. Like, we have to learn how to speak that, yes, a potato does go with steak and potatoes, but a potato also goes in an aloo paratha or a potato rosti or a biryani. You know, like, we have to learn those conversations, which I never thought before today was a skill set. I guess it's a survival instinct for second gen kids, you know, like, the duality is a survival instinct, but it's actually, you know, you should try and build a consulting kind of gig out of this, because you're onto something there.
Except you're the consultant. This is, if anything, I'm activating in you your entrepreneurial mind when it comes to this, because you're absolutely right. Survival instincts in one context are entrepreneurial innovations in another. And, you know, this is why I think the insular nature of the policy world, of the sectoral leadership of agri-food, is a liability, because we miss the opportunities, we miss the values, and you're kind of describing it. On the one hand, you're kind of helping expand people's palate by giving them, you know, new recipes, or to your point, how to deal with picky eaters amongst kids or amongst family members. But you're also at the same time achieving a cultural literacy where, you know, on the one hand, you're using language that matches people's frame of reference, but not at the exclusion of Punjabi cultural references, or not at the exclusion of ingredients that might have been traditionally in these dishes. And that in and of itself, while you describe it as a survival instinct, I see it as food literacy. So instead of people thinking, oh, lentils, that's something we export, it becomes lentils, that's something I can make with dal. That would be so great. And it's these small steps that take an industry like agri-food from something that's commodity-based to something that is much richer, much more value-added, and positions Canada within the rest of the world. Now I'm rambling and going on digressions. Why don't we come back to the kind of responses? Because, again, we're able, in hindsight's 2020, we can look back at what you've done and go, oh, Raj, that's so brilliant. Look at all the things you've done. But you have done this kind of out of passion and out of your own sense of intuition. So what has the reaction been around as you've done it along the way? How have the, whether it's the CBC, whether it's by BC, I'm curious to hear about how you have been kind of helping people understand the value of food education, of food literacy, and of doing the kind of work that you do.
You know, there's a couple things in that we want to pull off of, but to answer your question, that, you know, I think in the last 10 years, I have definitely seen that there is a lot more understanding for regional nuance. Like, for me, my first roadblock when I started telling my food stories is that I identify as Punjabi, which is a state inside of India. And Indian food is generally sort of homogenized under one bucket. And a lot of people said, you know, it would be a lot easier if you just said it was Indian food. Or, you know, some people want you to call yourself South Asian. And, you know, that's fine for whatever framework somebody decided at some point fit their understanding. But it's not fine because being Punjabi is so distinctly different than being from, say, a state like Gujarat or Rajasthan or Maharashtra. Like, you can cross 30 kilometers in India and you're in a new language, a new culture, a new food identity. So I think, like, my first battle was to really battle for the fact that even people within my own community, other chefs, were frustrated with me. You know, they were like, why are you making it harder? So, like, you know, that was my first battle. And initially it felt very lonely because I'm still one of the few voices in North America that identifies as a Punjabi chef. Most people say Indian, you know, and in Western, I believe currently in Canada, someone recently told me that I might have the largest recipe-based page of somebody who's an Indian food blogger or a food content creator. But then it always comes back to, you know, I'm Punjabi, not Indian. So that was a bit of a struggle. And, you know, when you go into mainstream media and you're pitching ideas and you're like, you know, I want to call this dal what it's called in my home, just even though on restaurant menus it's called this, or even though it might be easier for Google search if it was in Hindi. So, you know, those little nuances, I think, you know, when we think about the agri-food sector as a whole, I think about what small producers could learn from that is that there are cultures that, like, there are hundreds of thousands of people here in Canada, and they're looking for ingredients, they're looking for things that you might break the market and you might make something that just that culture is looking for. But to do that, you have to stop looking at them as Southeast Asia and South Asia and Africa. You know, like, you if you start looking at regional nuance, there are so many products that are missing on shelves. There are so many, like, produce items that are missing. So for me, that was something that I always thought about. But over the years, it's gotten easier.
If I could just kind of reinforce your point by distinguishing, say, Punjabi food and Punjabi culture, you're not only reinforcing your own sense of identity, your own sense of culture, but you're then creating value in the marketplace, where then I, as a consumer, instead of going for Indian food, I'm going to start wanting Punjabi food. And the reason I kind of identify with this was, you know, when I was living in Toronto for a period, I was a real big fan of Tamil cuisine. And there were a number of Tamil restaurants that I would often go to and bring my friends to. And there were a lot of political reasons why these Tamil restaurants were distinguishing themselves and engaging in that level of cultural distinction. But it fostered loyalty amongst consumers, amongst their customers, because they then understood the reason these dishes were different, the reason the ingredients were different, and the larger culture that it existed in. So it's not just an issue of category distinction. I think it's also an issue of creating value add and desire to the food itself. Does that make sense?
100%. So we live in a world right now where everybody's a foodie. I don't use that word because I feel like it doesn't really mean anything anymore. Like, what does it even mean to be a foodie? But everywhere you go, people are like, I'm a foodie. This is my favorite hole in the wall space. This is my fa I'm, you know, I'm trying this new spice. I'm trying this new recipe. People are watching all the cooking shows. So there is like, and this kind of goes back a step to when you were talking about how we treat the consumer. When we think of When it comes to selling food in the agri-food space, I think it's a real miss when we think of the consumer. We have to think of the eater. We have to think of all of the drivers that go behind why we eat what we eat, whether it's like the financial motivation, sorry, the health, the cultural drivers, or the food adventurers. So there's this giant opportunity that exists. Like, I'm consulting on a project right now with someone who is working on a, I can't say because I don't want to say what it is, but it's an herb that is missing, that a culture needs, and it's an herb that, you know, can be done here in Canada, but no one's thought about it. And I kind of feel like it's going to make people feel they're going to walk into the store, they're going to see this herb, and they're going to be like, ah, home. You know, they're going to feel so connected to it. And imagine how many other products exist in, you know, I'm only an expert kind of on my region. I have a deep understanding of like the South Asian cuisines, but there are probably experts everywhere in all sorts of regional cuisines that if we could make partnerships, you know, between the people on social media who hear consumers every day saying, sorry, not consumers, but like people who hear conversations every day where someone's saying, oh, you know, I'm looking for XY thing, but I can't find it here in Canada. This happens to me almost every day. You know, I have a lot of immigrant followers. I can't find this. So I'll say, oh, you know what? That's not available, especially if you don't want to import it. But here's some other items that I think have similar flavor profiles. And there are probably people who can do this for every region of the world. So if there was a way to create a partnership between producers, policy, you know, retail marketers, like everything, your ears to the ground are the people that are on social media to kind of like, you know, to say what we've been saying all along. You cannot get better real-time data than what content creators on social media are making or you know, learning or hearing. So, you know, and to go to your point about regional nuance, like imagine how much brand loyalty and trust a food brand could create if people who felt overlooked, who felt like their cuisine wasn't important or their culture hasn't been recognized, suddenly saw a product in the market that spoke to them. You can't buy that kind of brand loyalty with marketing dollars. Like, you know, once people are loyal to something, they're loyal to it when it comes to food.
And not just that, but it reinforces your point about eaters and the emotions and the psychology that goes into an eater. Because you just evoked the scenario that I seem quite likely where, you know, let's say there's a particular ingredient that a community's passionate about, they can't get a hold of. Someone produces it in small enough quantity, let's say initially, that everyone's excited. And it's that emotion on social media, which becomes infectious. The community's excited that they now have access to an ingredient or a herb they wanted. But then everyone else watching them goes, wow, look how excited they are about that ingredient. I want that ingredient. I need to have that ingredient. All of a sudden, you got a craze going on. Because that's how social media works in terms of the infectiousness of that energy. You know, and very briefly, because again, I'm digressing again. A couple of episodes ago, we had Camden Lawrence from the First Nations Agricultural Bank. Basically, they help finance Indigenous agriculture across the country. And he dropped this brilliant piece of knowledge, which is, you know, people don't realize that the price of basil is higher than the price of cannabis. And that if people, instead of trying to have illegal grow ops, had legal basil grow ops, the amount of revenue for the community would be tremendous. And you're kind of describing a similar opportunity that there's all these communities throughout Canada that on social media are providing signals that growers could be tapping into, that if they started growing these ingredients again, the signals we get from the diasporas here in Canada then position us to start feeding cultures around the world. I'm rambling again, but are we kind of on the same page here in terms of understanding this opportunity?
Absolutely. And this is not rambling. This is excitement. This is us just trying to get the message out because, you know, everything you said, like, think about the viral feta pasta, the Dubai chocolate bar, gochujang, kimchi. These were not all mainstream items before they went viral on TikTok. But we generally tend to think of them as like a product it has to be. But, you know, there's this wild herb used in Punjabi saag, which is kind of like a stewed mustard greens dish. It's called batu, and it grows everywhere in BC. It's wild everywhere. But last summer, a couple of BC blueberry farmers, their grandma told them, hey, do you know what this is? And they put it on social media and said, you can come and get this for free. I was one of the people that was like, I'm 100% going to go and get this herb, right? But it was like it was such a fun social experiment. Like somebody who was a blueberry grower, his grandma was like, do you know in India we used to cook with this? And, you know, obviously, please follow all the rules. I don't want to get anyone in trouble with what you're supposed to do and not do in terms of food safety. But when I saw that, I thought, wow, like there's a demand for this thing, which is growing like a weed in BC. And this then pertains to like educating ourselves. You know, we get into, in any industry, I'm not trying to dog on one industry. We have our blind spots, you know, we have our head down, we're focused on, we're like, this is what we've always grown. This is what we've always done, you know, and when we start talking to other people, when we create like incubator opportunities, when we have conversations, that's where I think that this kind of real innovative, creative opportunities will come out. And to be fair, you know, we talk a lot about the cost to the end product user, to the eaters, but agriculture is expensive for the farmers also. So imagine if there's a farmer out there who has like a really amazing opportunity just there, but they don't know about it because they haven't talked to the person who can recognize what they have.
Well, and, you know, let's use that as an opportunity to talk about what you're doing with Buy BC, because it is, I think, a really smart way to take the stuff we're talking about today and kind of close the loop. And you alluded to it in the sense that there's herbs that are growing wild in parts of Canada that we ignore, but that are of great value to certain cultures, certain cuisines. And as people recognize either the taste or the nutritional value, you know, attitudes change. But there is a communications piece to all of that, because on the one hand, you know, the farmers have to understand what's going on with the eaters have to understand, you know, to your point of cauliflower, when crops are in season, when they're affordable, when they're in abundance, and then what to do with them. So, you know, talk about the work you're doing, the kind of ambassadorship that really helps to make these connections in a way that, again, I think we're looking at a model of leadership that we should be replicating right across the country.
Yeah, I mean, I think first off, like, you know, kudos to the Buy BC team for thinking about it this way. You know, this is a role that there was, you know, a process for, there was a bid process for, I applied for this role. And I think, you know, first off, this is a really great example of like innovative thought leadership, to not assume that you have to have, you know, a technical chef in this role. One of the things that, you know, the team and I have talked about a lot is the importance of connecting with home cooks. I think often when we think about brands and they want to promote something, you know, we think about chefs. And, you know, again, this is a very like gray area where being a chef who specializes in ethnic cuisine is different than being a chef who specializes in French cuisine, say. But, you know, often as content consumers, when a brand, before social media, brands often looked at things as like, let's get a pro chef, you know, a chef who's going to do a certain kind of technique or a certain kind of plating. But the perspective with Buy BC from the very beginning, from where I've started my role, has been, how can we take products that are readily available in BC, that are in season, and introduce them to home cooks if they're not already using them, or show home cooks how they can incorporate them into their cultural recipes, which, you know, we've done some unique pieces where we've taken something that wouldn't traditionally sit in a Punjabi recipe, but we've brought it in. And, you know, the idea really just is to Because at the end of the day, you know, there's all these people that are in the agri-food system. There's a supply chain, there's policy, there's all that. But at the end of the day, the last mile, the farm to plate is in somebody's kitchen who has 30 minutes, limited budget, limited time, you know, and that's the people that through BuyBC we're trying to talk to. We're trying to be like, you don't need to buy 15 ingredients. Like, let's just focus on one ingredient, do it well. And, you know, in the process, we're trying to tell really cool producer stories. You know, like I did a piece in November on an eggless hazelnut cake. Hazelnuts are not necessarily the most economical option. But a lot of people said, you know, now that I know they're grown in BC, I'm interested to try them because I didn't know you could grow hazelnuts in BC. So it's a fine balance, you know, because yes, we are in a time where economics matters. Like, all Canadians are worried about the cost of groceries. I am worried about the cost of groceries, like, you know, so economics matters. But I think if you can tell a good story, people will splurge on an ingredient. And all of that kind of to come full circle is, are you creating community? Are people invested in your brand or you online? Do they trust you? Do they want to support you? Then they will pay the extra $2 at the checkout, even if they have to let it go from somewhere else. But they won't just because you put up a flashy ad.
I think what you're evoking there is the power of culture. And culture is something we often take for granted, the way that, you know, fish often don't think of the taste of water. But culture determines what we want to eat, how much we're willing to pay, who we share it with. And I think much of the agri-food industry is kind of, dare I say it, culturally illiterate, because they just kind of accept that culture is there versus, to your point, the survival instinct of a second generation Canadian is to be very conscious of culture, because you exist in multiple cultures and you have to code switch often between cultures. And I do want to unpack that, but I want to connect that to something that you've also repeatedly evoked today, and you just brought it up in terms of the chef. That it used to be they might go to a very technically oriented or highly trained and certified chef. But these days, the credibility and authority is probably coming from a home chef. It's probably coming from a chef who, like yourself, has earned their authority sharing knowledge on the internet. And so what I kind of want to tease out and get you to riff off is this idea that the next authority can come out of anywhere, often within just a few weeks. And you've talked about that in terms of how social media works. But you also kind of talked about that in terms of, you know, maybe someone identifies a herb that is really valuable that all of a sudden sweeps the country. That makes them an authority. So how do we kind of reconcile this idea that anyone who's listening to us right now could find an opportunity in the agri-food space and leverage that opportunity with their communication skills to become a leader? I'm digressing again, but I'm doing so because I suspect that you're going to have something really smart to say in response.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to break that up into two parts. So first, I want to say I have the utmost respect for culinary training and chefs who run commercial kitchens. It's not that I don't respect that. I just think we're in a shifting world today. And I have some culinary training, and I am still in the process, because at one point I figured, you know, I need to understand what I'm talking about when I'm talking about other types of cuisines. I have the utmost respect for that, but I think I do not think that just because you can run a brigade in a commercial kitchen, you can run an Instagram page where you teach food, where you connect people to food. They're two different skill sets. And I also think that, you know, much of what we've talked about today has reminded us that ethnic foods, different culture, the way we cook, the way that we learn to cook in community, we don't all work in a brigade style kitchen. So it doesn't resonate for everybody. And today, anybody can take something that they're passionate about. If they have a little bit of communication skill, online, not so much presence, but if you're comfortable on camera, if you're non-comfortable on camera, you can figure out workarounds. But really, I come up against this a lot, and perhaps this, maybe I shouldn't even say this, but I'm going to say it, that a lot of times I have had people who believe that they are experts because of a different world told them they were an expert. You know, there was a time when a certain certificate or a certain training or a certain checkmark meant you were more of an expert than me. But we live in the wild, wild west of leadership and expertise now. Like anyone could take what they know, and if you can distill that into an approachable, friendly, authentic format, you can be the expert. You can be the expert on tomatoes. You can be the expert on potatoes. You can be a cheese expert. And you know what? You can even choose to do it in a condescending way. Lots of people do it really well in a condescending way. I just don't recommend that as a brand. As a brand, I think you should be open to feedback. There's lots of people that are like, you know, their voice online is, I am the expert because. I don't think that's what a brand should do, but you have to find your voice. And I also think it's a bit, I think we're in a world where there's a lot of like reality, people are facing reality. There's a lot of shock. They're like, but I'm the expert, but I have less followers than this person who's just passionately talking in their kitchen about something. Or someone's like, I have always planted this. It has always sold. You know, at Christmas time, this product always sells. Well, surprisingly, Christmas or another holiday now is diverse. Not everybody is making the same bird or the same side or the same. And, you know, some of those people are actually not even minorities. It's Eurocentric communities who want more flavor in their food now. They're like, maybe we're not going to do this. Like, I think, you know, you just have to open your mind. You want, if you want your brand to stand on social media, if you want to stand for thought leadership, and if you want to stand for thought leadership in the agri-food space, the first thing that you can do is be honest. Do not be defensive. If people tell you food is expensive, if people tell you groceries are expensive, if they're confused by food labels, I see this a lot online where people get really defensive and they toe that company line and they have these like perfectly crafted PR statements. I don't think you build communities like that. You build communities by being honest and saying, we're in it with Canadians. I've gone on a rant, but the whole of this to say is like, it doesn't matter what your degree says. It doesn't matter what your experience says today. It matters, I think, what you speak to people, and it matters that people feel respected.
And I hope you're having half as much fun with this conversation as I am, because I am certainly learning a ton, and it's helping me really connect the dots on some of my own thinking. And in particular, I think what you just helped me realize is that authority now is based more on your ability to ask questions than it is on your ability to offer answers. And that's part of the reason why on the internet anyone can become an expert, because everything's changing so quickly that if you ask the right questions, that could lead you to new knowledge, which then establishes your expertise. You may not be the top expert, but you're an expert. You're able to kind of participate. And that's part of why I think diversity is so essential to a thriving sector. And we've been talking about that kind of around it, and talking about the value of culture, the value of understanding and listening to communities, the kind of the advantages that second generation Canadians have in being able to have their feet in both cultures, in all cultures. But I'm curious, as we kind of wrap up, and this is another crazy abstract question, but I suspect you're going to have an interesting answer. How do you stay curious? Because it's obvious to me that curiosity has been a big part of your creativity, of your attitude, right? You're kind of seeing the internet as an opportunity rather than as a dysfunctional mess, and that is something I wrestle with myself. But how do you, on the assumption that you are curious, how do you maintain that? How do you fuel that curiosity? And what role do you think curiosity plays in this model of leadership that we're kind of evoking today?
Okay, so I am definitely a curious person. My kids call them side quests, and I usually have many, many side quests at any given time. But I think the key about being curious, and you're absolutely right, like being curious is the number one thing I think that allows you to be allows you to be a leader on social media, because you have to be coming up with new stuff all the time. You have to come up with new ways to present it, but you don't find that on social media. So this is the kind of hard part. I allow myself some time on social media just to scroll. I don't care. I know people say it's brain rot and stuff, but sometimes I just scroll and I watch silly things. But when it comes to actually being curious about the stuff that I want to do, beyond the conversations I have in my DMs and my comments, then I like try to take it off a line. And I think something that really helps when you are a blank slate, like I was when I started, I learned to cook on the internet with people. I learned the internet with people. I think coming to it as, I don't know everything. I think sometimes with the old guard, with people who sit in leadership positions, your number one problem is if you think you know everything, you've already lost the battle on social media. And then you have to keep learning. Like, that's the other thing. Like, I have taken classes on pastry making. I have taken classes on Thai cooking. I took a writing workshop in London once. I, you know, read a lot. I read a lot around what, actually, I read a lot that has nothing to do with what I do for work, but I feel like I really try to stay connected to the written word, because I feel like this is maybe a little off topic, but we get so caught up in social media being about the photos, the videos, the recipes, but at the end of the day, it's about the storytelling. So I try to constantly work on like consuming. If I'm consuming, I try to consume good stories. But really, I think you nailed it earlier when you said, keep your ears open and listen, you know, like ask questions of everybody and anybody you can. And perhaps this is a good way to sort of sum up what I think of leadership, is that when you're in a leadership position, you have got to ask a question of everybody, from the person that's the farm laborer, you know, who's picking the fruit, to the person who's packing it, to the person who's eating it. Like, we start to think of certain people, we start to think of specific people in communities as the expert, the editor that knows, the chef that knows, you know, the tastemaker that knows. And I think that world is gone. I think we can be more curious, we can be better thought leaders, we can produce really amazing products here in Canada if we were talking to different people, like you said, diverse, unique voices across social classes, across cultures. And that's where the magic will come of content creation too.
Right on. This has been an absolute tour de force. We're coming to the last question. And this last question, like the first question, is really meant to be a kind of curveball, something that catches you a little off guard. But I'm a big believer in the kind of each one teach one principle. And so I like to end the episode by asking the leader that we've been talking about, and what a phenomenal leader you are, Raj. Are there any leaders that you look up to, that you follow on social media? This is kind of the shout out part of the show. Are there folks that you're paying attention to that we should be paying attention to in terms of, you know, either different models of leaders or just leaders that you think are kind of cool?
I wish I had thought about this a little more and prepared for it, because obviously, you know, when you have that moment when there are so many people, but your brain goes blank. But one person who I'm really inspired by right now is my fellow BYBC ambassador, Michael. He has this amazing knack for how he teaches people things that should be inaccessible information. It is stuff that in the past would be under the guard of, like, you had to train in a Michelin starred restaurant to know these things. And Michael is just making it accessible to home cooks in a way that I find so inspiring. There are so many other people, and I'm happy to send you some for show notes, but right now, when you said it in the context of the conversation we're having right now, like, if I was in AgriFood right now, I would look at his stuff and I would see, like, this would be a great way to teach people to distill knowledge and to have faith in people that they're smart enough to process whatever you're teaching them. Like, he has so much faith in home cooks that, you know, I can teach you something that is such a, like, a fine dining technique, but you can learn it. And I love that about him.
Right on. And you're getting the gist of what I'm trying to achieve as an interviewer, in that I think food is very much something of the gut. And I want as many of the questions as possible to go straight to the gut and get that instinctual response. So again, you did fantastic in that regard. I have to selfishly say that I have enjoyed this conversation so much. I would love to have you back, if only because you kind of started by evoking AI. And I think the role of the algorithm has kind of been beneath the surface of our conversation. So I suspect we would have a lot of fun talking about that subject amongst many others. So I would very much love to have you back, and no pressure to answer now. But the last thing we'll end on, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me online as Pink Chai. I am on Instagram, TikTok, not so much. I'm trying to learn that app, and YouTube. And it's at Pink Chai. Pink like the color, chai like the drink.
And to your point about consuming social media, TikTok is very much my guilty pleasure, if only because I find it really does connect me with lots of educators, people making all sorts of interesting food and doing so in a very accessible way. So I do encourage you to check it out and lean into it further, only because I think your brilliance and expertise would play very well on that platform. Thanks again. This has been absolutely fantastic. Fantastic. I feel a little guilty in that when I have episodes as amazing as this so early in the arc of our show, we may run into difficulty maintaining the quality of the conversation moving forward. But nonetheless, thank you for setting the bar so high, Raj.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
If there's something to carry forward from today's conversation, it's that the food system doesn't end at production, and it doesn't fail there either. What Raj makes visible is a layer that's often overlooked, precisely because it feels informal. The decisions that shape demand, normalize ingredients, and ultimately determine what becomes viable are happening in everyday practice. And how people cook, what they feel comfortable attempting, and what they pass on to loved ones. That has consequences, because it suggests that many of the challenges we talk about, market access, local adoption, even resilience, aren't only technical or economic, they're cultural. And they require a different kind of intervention. Not just more supply or better policy, but more translation. More literacy, and more people doing the kind of work that Raj is doing. It also raises a sharper question for the sector. Who are we recognizing as leaders? If influence over taste and habit is as consequential as influence over production, then the map of the food system starts to look different. And I'm sure glad we were able to have Raj on the show to demonstrate that. This conversation doesn't resolve that tension, but it does make it harder to ignore. Raj is not alone. She's part of a growing cohort of teachers, of learners, of influencers, leaders who are connecting the loop when it comes to how we consume food, how we love food, how we share food. And as the system continues to change, you know, that might be a useful place for us to be paying attention. And similarly, a useful place for this episode to come to a close. Not with answers, but with a clearer sense of where the real leverage might be, where the real opportunities might be. Until then, we'll see you next time here on The Future Herd.